This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me Tan Chung Han, and the morning run continues.
Kicks off. Good morning.
It kicks off, yeah. Right? It continues from yesterday, huh? And it kicks off, you know. And
it's an endless morning, like, just 24 hours of
morning. It's Groundhog Day. It feels that way. And Groundhog Day, you know, that wonderful little movie, I think based on that well-known fact about how people in some parts of the U.S. look at groundhogs to tell whether it's the start of spring, isn't it? The end of winter.
Basically when winter ends, yeah. If the groundhog can see its shadow. Yeah.
That's right. Well. So groundhogs are very sensitive creatures, clearly. Okay, Mosul in Iraq has been liberated from IS control. Though, you know, one wonders about the ideology that animated that movement as a whole, and whether that can be, you know, quelled successfully. I think also, you know, Han, for us in Southeast Asia, the idea that IS is, you know, being pushed back so successfully in that part of the world might mean for us that there might be increased activity in this part of the world. In fact, I believe the Marawi city siege is not yet over. You know, it's almost dropped off the radar. It's been so long. It's been more than a month and a half now, I think. And it's something to revisit in the recent past. I think the president, Rodrigo Duterte, said, or reports came out that he might have been trying to do a deal with them.
Yeah, so you've got the U.S. labeling this victory as a significant milestone. I mean, keeping in mind that this bloody campaign in Mosul lasted nearly 9 months, killed thousands of people, you know, displaced over 1 million people. This is Iraq's second largest city, you know. So, I mean, well, 9 months, I guess, you know, relative to the protracted war that we're seeing in Syria and other parts of the Middle East, you know, 9 months appears, at least to me, like relatively short, but nevertheless, hopefully this will be significant in turning the tide there in this fight against IS.
Also, more bad news, militants kill Hindu pilgrims in Kashmir. The ongoing conflict in Kashmir continues unabated, and India seems to be incapable of containing that, either responding to, you know, Kashmiri citizens and their aspirations, and or dealing with the militancy. Also, on a lighter note, Bertha, the world's oldest hippo, dies at the age of 65. And perhaps, depending on who you ask, a light news, Trump's son admits he met with a Russian lawyer with information on his then rival, his father's rival, Hillary Clinton, says there was nothing unusual in it, and the lawyer that he met, claiming to represent people with information on Hillary Clinton, had nothing significant.
Right, nothing significant, but, you know, the fact that that meeting was confirmed now, and given the fact that U.S. Congress is now back to work starting on Monday, that's overnight Malaysian time, you know, so I wonder how much of that news might cloud the Trump agenda, you know, given that they have a really packed agenda for the next 3 weeks before their month-long break in August.
Yeah, you know, there's a very interesting discussion yesterday on Bloomberg about whether Trump should dump the healthcare, the repeal and replace, repeal and replace Obamacare legislative move, and just move on to something that he can actually win at, like perhaps tax reform and such. The analysts seem to be quite uncertain about the ability for Trump's administration to push on its legislative agenda. All that, I guess, you'll be picking up later on in the morning. But here's Caravan by Van Morrison, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Van Morrison and Caravan. Van Morrison's one of my favorite singers. Just, I love his voice. I'm sure I couldn't.
And I'm Tan Chung Han.
Wow, we did that. Okay. Very classy of us, isn't it? Okay, it's a Tuesday morning and we sound like it's deep. It's like we had an extra long week to contend with. We don't. It's just 5 days.
I think it's the weather, though. Oh,
it must be.
Word.
The weather. It is pouring out there.
It was.
It's only 10 past 6 in the morning and it's very wet out there. And I think if you're driving, please drive very carefully. Maybe a little slower than you would ordinarily. Because people always get into trouble
right.
on these roads.
And especially, you know, as we consider how this weather is utterly conducive for, you know, a lion.
Like
snuggled in bed. But, you know, hey, we obviously are responsible people, and not just us here in the studio, but also you listening right now. And we have our commitments and our daily routines to tend to. So.
Yeah, I mean, you know, neither snow or rain or sleet. But that's a kind of old saying about postmen.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a postman.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, anyway. So moving on to the deluge of information that we get on a daily basis, a lot of number crunching around the world as to how much information and content, if you like to call it, is consumed by the average person. I think in the wired up places of planet Earth, which includes quite a bit of the globe, people, and say if you take Americans, for instance, consume some 34 gigabytes of content and encounter some 100,000 written words from various sources in a single day. That's an American scenario. I would think that it's not too different here in Malaysia, where we're big Facebook consumers. It doesn't really matter the quality of that content or what's written in those 100,000 words, but it's just the sheer quantity.
So you have a cognitive load theory, which suggests that, you know, our brains really have, you know, so much bandwidth to actually digest all this information. So perhaps there needs to be this filtering, because obviously we now find ourselves in a time when we are just overloaded with so much information from so many sources, and so how do you keep your sanity, so to speak? Because according to this article on QZ.com, there have been a significant amount of stress being associated with information overload, right?
Yeah, you know, so if you are a journalist, this becomes a professional hazard. But if you're not a journalist, there are ways of getting beyond this, because what information overload can do is it can lead to something called, and it's a very nasty sounding word, infobesity. Infobesity, as you imagine, is being overloaded with information. You become emotionally bloated, intellectually ineffective, and also cranky and distracted. So all those bad things, so it results from info binging. You might not even know you're binging. You know you're binging when you have finished a tub of ice cream in front of the television, but you might not recognize that the television itself is a source of material that your brain is overloading on, and leading you to some levels of stress.
Yeah, so according to this article, they suggest a couple of ways to perhaps detox from this infobesity, and one would be just pure silence. How about this? So they cited a couple of instances. For example, you have Phil Sanderson. Phil Sanderson is a partner at IDG Ventures in San Francisco, you know, and he actually took a week off from speaking back in February this year, even though being a venture capitalist, speaking is his thing. And you know, they cite how after taking this period of silence, he's then able to more meaningfully engage with the world and, you know, be more selective in what kind of information he processes.
Okay, so he basically stopped doing what he does on a regular basis as part of his job. But I wonder if the silence that you need is more than just simply tuning out from your job. If you're still at home and you're still reading and watching TV, and if you're still talking to people, is that constitute enough information to lead to some level of information obesity?
What not? I think it goes beyond that. It's, you know, silence, or being able to kind of put a stop to language. So it's not even music, you know, with song and lyrics. It includes that, you know, no reading, just language in general.
So, you know, yesterday, Han, I did a session of yoga. And I mean, part of yoga, not that I'm a big fan of yoga, and, you know, I practice it on and off, as my bloated infobesity body would suggest, that, you know, it's really good for this kind of deep silence that you need. And of course, there are things like Vipassana, which is a form of meditation, which also includes long periods. I mean, like a week or 10 days of silent and silent meditation.
Yeah, 10 days, try 17 years. That's what environmental activist John Francis, well, that's apparently how long he went for without speaking. So he decided one day in 1973 to stop speaking, didn't speak again until 1990. So, you know, I mean, that's a bit extreme. Or I guess maybe you can just be content with watching cat videos. No language there.
Yeah, but there's still gigabytes of information. Yeah. Cat videos, it's like eating cat food, canned cat food. I think it's not good for you.
What?
I don't know. I just think cat videos are really dangerous for your health. Really, truly. After this, we have, these messages, rather, we have New Order and True Faith, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin. That was New Order with True Faith. And along with me, because Tan Chung Han, he's all bubbly this morning, Tuesday.
And having a lot of faith in
11th of July. Yeah, well, you know, talking about True Faith, I mean, I think one of the touchstones for freedom and democracy in the world today is the fact that the internet is there for all of us to access information and cut through, you know, government obfuscation. In fact, if obfuscation that comes from any quarter, never mind government. And but there's a pushback, and there's always been a pushback on the internet. In Malaysia, because we had the multimedia super corridor, its charter, and the promise of a free cyberspace that came because during the Mahathir era, despite the political repression at the tail end of that administration. And I think that it's an interesting paradox as we go forward into the 21st century that countries... both very modern and somewhat struggling, like Afghanistan, are pushing for control over the internet. And the new concept that's being pushed by China is the idea of cyber sovereignty. I mean, you heard this expression, Han.
Yeah, well, certainly. But also at the same time, keeping in mind this agenda, so to speak, is not just confined to the likes of China or Afghanistan. You've also got Germany, who have threatened Facebook with a fine of up to $55 million, you know, if they don't raise the level of censorship. So, I mean, granted...
But over a particular kind of speech,
yeah,
right?
Well, hate speech, right? So then it goes, it begs the question, right? Then how do you define what is appropriate in cyberspace? So obviously Afghanistan is drawing a different where they draw the line in the sand will be different from, say, China, and will be different from where Germany, but nevertheless there is this discussion that ongoing, because if you're a full proponent of free speech, right, that would mean by default that you would have to allow room for hate speech, for racist speech, you know, sexist, like you name it, or even what the Islamic State is doing via social media, then
recruitment,
then you would have to allow for that, right? Because if you then say a line has to be drawn somewhere, then isn't that censorship by nature?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And in fact, you know, if you look at something like the UN, they've already come up with some protocols. There's something called the Johannesburg principles. We can check it out, Johannesburg, as in the city of Johannesburg and in South Africa. And this outlines, in some sense, what one might consider criminal hate speech, as opposed to, you know, just hate speech in general. Because I think what you don't want to do in controlling the kind of speech that mobilizes people to hurt others, you know, to join militant groups to hurt others and all that, is to put a damper on how people think about the world, you know, because it's never going to go away. I mean, that's my opinion. Right. What's your opinion, Hannah?
Well, you know, then what do you do about trolls then? Because if, let's say, you just draw the line and say physical hurt, but obviously we now know that cyberbullying, even though it doesn't necessarily involve physical harm, you know, that is very much rampant in various social media platforms, right? So do you allow for that and just draw the line at saying, okay, you know, we will only stop these instances sentences or these kind of speech which leads to physical violence. So, again, I mean, I get it. It can be quite a slippery slope argument.
Yeah,
here,
and
right?
that's important to know, to recognize that it is, in fact, a slippery slope, meaning that when you start at this point, you end up allowing for greater and greater censorship. Mm. And the only people that benefit are the people already in power. So what you don't want to do is to concede more power to those already who have a disproportionate amount of power. And being very cognizant that, you know, this is not neither a new conundrum nor one that hasn't had some serious thought. And that's why I brought up the Johannesburg principles, because I think there you've had a series of discussions and then, you know, articulated it as a document on how to manage this, how to find the sweet spot.
And it's also important to realize that it's the regulators or those in authority who have the power to actually draw that line in the sand. I mean, also keeping in mind when it comes to netizens, by nature, there are so many differing voices and schools of thought here. It's where, you know, how do you try and derive some kind of cohesive policy stance, you know, for you to then enact, you know, across.
Right. So when it talks about control, you can talk about what ought to be and what is. And of course, the is the fact that people are in power and the regulators control us. The question is, should they and should we legitimize that? All of which we can continue to discuss after the news bulletin is coming out shortly. But before that, we have the Beatles. And I feel fine. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Tan Chung Han. And the morning run continues. A lot to talk about because we have had in the news, Han, and, you know, this is part of our professional hazard, you know, one of the many hazards. One is infobesity. The other is reacting far too quickly to things that come out in the media. Now, we had sort of a reversal in understanding what happened to that young boy who was at a religious school. He died, remember? His legs were dark and bloated, and then he was in a coma, and eventually he succumbed to his condition. Now, initially, the reports suggested that he was abused. Now we learn that, in fact, what killed him was something different, though it was a complicated matter. Also, we had in the news recently suggestions that, remember that Kelantan anime boy, the Kelantanese boy who spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on reconstructing his face, and there was a lot of kerfuffle about whether, you know, this was right or wrong and what he had done to his face. Well, it turns out he might not have done the surgery, that he's pulled one over the public, that in fact what he presents to the public in this is a Photoshop version of himself. So say some sources. So we have these two stories that seem quite different, but the important thing is in both instances we all responded far too quickly. We took positions, and were we wrong to do that in this day and age?
Right, and I guess that shed some light on my rather cautious stance, although I've been chided by some listeners for having the kind of apprehension on air before. You know. But, you know, it is because of these kind of instances which really should give us pause, right? And especially when, you know, we are just fed with an endless stream of information and very much a lot of it is unsubstantiated, and we are forced to make this judgment and analysis immediately. And I think,
yeah, you know, I think your call for caution is absolutely right, and I think it is distinguished from having a worldview and values. I mean, that can remain regardless of the facts of specific cases. But you're right. In some ways, we are compelled to respond immediately to a situation where we're presented with only partial facts, or at least too partial to have a fuller understanding. Because you can imagine 100 years from now, this history and all that we lived through will seem very different to our, you know, our the people who come after us. But the point is, at this point in time, as full of the facts as you can get, are we getting them? And why is it? Because it's social media, isn't it? I mean, so many ways, Facebook and Twitter all get us jumping far too quickly, far too high, and sometimes we even make mistakes like not looking at the timeline of a story. And I've done that myself. I've know others who have done that. There's just this pressure to respond.
Right. And so in this instance with Muhammad Taqif, I mean, Muhammad Gaddafi, who is that 11-year-old boy who died. Now, here's the thing. Even after this, the medical report has been released, his mom still denies or refutes that report. No, she still insists on the, or I guess, the original allegations. You know, and that's at least reported by Malaysia Kini.
Okay, so he died of a condition associated with rat urine, you know, which we've seen in migrant detention centers and prisons and those kinds of conditions, right?
Right.
So that's already a bad enough, right? Why was the boy exposed to this? What's happening at the school that the hygiene of the school is so poor?
Presumably the school.
Presumably the school, right? Mm. The other thing, of course, is that he did have a condition where he had all these clots on his legs and all that. Now, we don't know where, at this point, I think the DG of Health has not explained where that came from. Could that have been from the beatings that he presumably got, at least allegedly got?
Right. Well, that was one of the issues we raised, I believe, when we first encountered this story, as to, like, you know, how a beating could have led to such severe physical consequences. It's one thing to have bruises, but judging by the pictures, it doesn't look like something, you know, that would be the result of just beatings, right? So now we know it's leptospirosis, right?
Yeah, that's the one that's associated with the rat urine.
But the point I'm trying to make here is this. Now, even with this official report now, and somewhat understandably, like, the mother is still rejecting the findings of the autopsy report.
I think
report.
That's fine. In fact, all that is, again, but it's also us. Remember, look at how we're always speculating on the basis of images we see in the newspaper.
Right.
We're not a forensic scientist, but we are, because of the nature of the work and also the society we're in, constantly asked to make judgment, pass judgment on these things.
And when we do pass those judgments or make those analyses, it's often filtered by our preconceived bias. And you just got to read the social media comments in relation to this update in this tragic story.
You'll
see what I mean. Yeah.
Bias is the word. Coming up after the messages, the Beach Boys and Here She Comes, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sherrod Kutin, waiting out that last beat on the song. That, of course, is... No, I was just looking at that. Is that the Beach Boys? No, yeah. Here She Comes. Beach Boys, I'm Sherrod Kutin, as I said, and with me, Tan Chung Han.
Good morning.
It's that lovely song. I just have to want to wait till the end of the song, just to hear it out.
Yeah, and just let it fade out.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay.
But some things are not going to fade away, including His Royal Highness, the Tunku Makota of Johor, his continued salvos against the political establishment. Is getting a lot of people are very excited. Of course, there are some people who have raised the flag of, you know, with regard to royals being involved in this way in public discourse, especially somebody who is very likely to take his father's place as the Sultan of Johor at some point in time. Now, that being that as it may, the question today is his most recent salvo against the culture of corruption and politicians in the country who want to be celebrities.
Celebrities and sportsmen.
So he'd sort of say, poking fun at them. The thing is, in his statement, he didn't quite name anybody, but social media was abuzz with presumptions based on what you earlier talked about, our prejudices, our biases, the landscape that we have in our minds about the people that run this country or, you know, oppose those who run this country and who they are and might be alluded to in such comments. So the Malaysian Insight has this story. Social media users poke fun at Khairi over TMJ article, because that's Khairi Jamaluddin, Minister of Youth and Sports.
Right, because this article by TMJ follows reports about how a youth and sports minister, Khairi Jamaluddin, has been picked for the national polo team for the upcoming SEA Games that will be held in KL. You know, so whether or not he has the credentials to actually be on that polo team, I think that's the essence of a lot of this backlash among social media circles. Now, it's also interesting because there have been reports of TMJ also challenging the SEA Games polo squad versus his own polo squad. And apparently, according to these media reports, TMJ's, that's Tengku Makota Johor, his team had actually beaten the Malaysian polo squad by a score of like 10-0 or 11-0. So, you know, very much raising the question about the credentials of the polo squad that will be representing Malaysia at the SEA Games.
Yeah, you think that working as a minister, as a full minister, would be, you know, work enough? How would you train for that? But, I mean, I leave that to the man himself. He clearly knows better, or feels he knows better, about how to manage his time. And I guess healthy ministers are always, at least bodily healthy, physically healthy, politicians are always good, because then they have the energy to run the country and govern well, you know, remembering that the constitution is supreme and that democracy is what people want.
And if he does, I hope he does well at the SEA Games, you know, then hopefully, you know, not only will it look good on the Malaysian sports team, but hey, you know, a minister who can actually excel in that ministry, in that field that he's supposed to represent and lead, yeah.
Oh, maybe. Well, I think this is a song that Malaysians might want to dedicate to their politicians. Lenny Kravitz, Are You Going My Way? BFM 89.9. Good morning, Tan Chung Han and myself, Sharad Kutin. And this is The Morning Run. It's coming up to half past six minutes. Well, six wow. and a half minutes past seven is what I'm trying to say. It's all very complicated this early in the morning.
Yeah, telling time, right?
Telling so time. Yeah, I know. I just looked at my phone. My watch. Actually, I'd use my phone to tell time. But yeah, let's move on to more important things. And this, of course, is a story that's in the news. And I don't know if, for most people, it's all a bit arcade. It's all involved in this procedural issues that have now been in some ways raised to a level of public debate. And this has to do with the appointment recently of two judges as additional judges in the keeping them in the administrative post. And this it's controversial because these judges were meant to retire. Now, George Varghese, president of the Malaysian Bar, tells us why the bar considers these appointments unconstitutional.
Okay, the reason the Malaysian Bar has taken the position that the two appointments of the CJ and the President of the Court of Appeal is unconstitutional simply because there is no provision. One, there is no provision for the CJ or the President of the Court of Appeal to remain in office after reaching the age of 66 years plus 6 months. This is specifically provided for in the federal constitution. That is one reason. Number two is there's also no provision for an additional judge to be appointed as the CJ or the President of the Court of Appeal. Hence why the Malaysian Bar holds the view that both these appointments are unconstitutional.
Now, one of the consequences of this is that it might give the impression that there are no suitable candidates among the existing judges to be elevated to those positions. And so George Varghese, again, president of the Malaysian Bar, continues to explain to us the implications of what's happened.
What could happen, it's a possibility that cases where the CJ or the President of the Court of Appeal, where they sit to decide on cases, those decisions may subsequently be challenged as on the grounds that one of the members of the quorum that decided it was appointed unconstitutionally, especially if there is a challenge to this appointment and subsequently it is declared that the appointments are unconstitutional. So it can even affect decisions of cases, and this will affect public and the litigants.
That was George Varghese, president of the Malaysian Bar, weighing in on this particular controversy that perhaps hasn't been taken up more widely because it involves a lot of arcane procedures.
And real quick, just to establish some details here, the CJ, that's the Chief Justice, is Tan Sri Muhammad Rawus Sharif, and the Court of Appeal President is Tan Sri Zulkifli Ahmad Makinuddin. So essentially, their appointments were actually made earlier this year, and also on April 1st for Tan Sri Muhammad Rawus, and also for Tan Sri Zulkifli, who both turned turned 66 earlier this year as well. But I think the broader question for those of us who are perhaps not familiar with what the Constitution says about the appointments and the limitations thereof would be the level of confidence, right, in the judiciary, because very often when we see the kind of rulings that are made by judges here in Malaysia, whether or not it fits your bias, as long once it falls out of your preconceived notions or your bias or out of your camp, so to speak, then there's this uproar. Like, the Malaysian justice system is corrupted and whatnot, right? So having these kind of more noise being associated with the judicial system here in Malaysia certainly doesn't go well in terms of trying to shore up confidence, right?
Okay, you call it noise, but actually what the Bar Council is providing us is with a view of the law, right, and the Constitution. And it doesn't help the system if things are done in an unconstitutional manner. In fact, not only that, it has repercussions, because if this is clearly a case of an unconstitutional extension of terms, then as George Vargas explained, it can then be challenged. Now, all cases that go up to these courts then become, mired in this problem of the constitutionality of the person's position that's sitting in that panel. And so, you talk about the noise coming from, these are noises from the late 80s. Remember the constitutional crisis we had with the judiciary? The Malaysian judiciary has never quite recovered from that blow that happened in the 80s. So I'm not quite sure if this is a problem of people and their biases jumping on. And certainly you're right that there is that kind of noise, but this I don't think fits into that. Is similar to that.
No, because I'm going off of what George Vargas said about the possibility that future decisions by these either the CJ or also the Court of Appeal president could then be
undermined.
There could be doubt cast upon those
decisions.
Yes, but
it's not on the basis of the judgment itself, but the fact that who sat.
Right. Exactly, yeah. So again, the point I was trying to make was then, how... having that kind of doubt associated with these two judges, and obviously, very these judges.
In fact, whether or not
they'll shore up the level of confidence, already we are seeing this confidence deficit, right? When it comes to the Malaysian judiciary.
Yeah, I think also what was noted by the bar was that they were no way casting a doubt on the abilities of the two men in question, and they in fact went on to urge the two men in question, the two judges in question, to decline the extensions because they would be unnecessarily, they would mar their own careers, and at this point in that trajectory. So, I think there was a lot of respect paid to the two individuals mentioned in this case. But what the bar seems to be doing is to remind us of the importance of playing by the rules. And the rules are set in large part by our constitution, not just by the politics of the day or the contingencies thereof and such. So a complicated matter, but one I think the bar is trying to help the Malaysian public understand better.
But also, we got the note, and it's important to highlight that the Malaysian bar did welcome the appointments of both Tan Sri Rao and Zulkifli when their respective appointments were made on April 1st. So again, it's not a question, like you said, it's not a question of their abilities or capabilities or even a suitability, right? And especially given that they have this such a long tenure now, only to be marred in this controversy, perhaps unwillingly, so late in their careers. But nevertheless, it's something that we should consider, especially given how important the judiciary is to the Malaysian ecosystem. Right?
Okay, we'll be back with more analysis after this. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.